Well, not everyone liked my Rosh Hashanah sermon. Go figure. Somebody online wrote that they didn't want to hear about the environment and why we changed our eternal light to a solar-powered light. They said they came to services to hear about religion. Okay. And now if you're intrigued, you can go to ourjewishcommunity.org in the archives and watch that sermon. But that's another conversation. But this person isn't alone in not liking the sermon a particular rabbi gives. A couple of years ago, I was in a group of rabbis. I was part of a study cohort of rabbis across the ideological religious spectrum. And we were sitting and we were meeting. We were in New York, I believe. We were all sitting around talking. And the conversation turned to Israel. And almost every rabbi there, conservative, reform, renewal, the entire spectrum, there was no Orthodox rabbis there, I don't believe, said, I no longer speak about Israel from the pulpit. It is too hot, too complicated, that no matter what I say, no matter how plain it might be, somebody gets upset. Somebody will say, I didn't look at this issue or that issue, I wasn't fair, I was being too harsh, I was being too kind. Now understand that this conversation took place 2 years ago before the recent events of this past summer, which has made speaking about Israel, Gaza, the Palestinian security even more charged. This summer, at least one rabbi I know of had to step down from his pulpit because of Israel. Boards are now restricting what rabbis can't and can't say. A few members have joined congregations, but more, if rabbis have spoken out, folks have left congregations over this topic. But lest you think it's only Israel or the environment, in that same conversation I was at with rabbis, we were talking, and one of the guys said, oh, I'm in the Southwest. He said, I can't talk about gun control. Talk about gun control, it will divide my congregation, so I don't. This was right after Sandy Hook, and many of the rabbis there wanted to address the issue of gun control, given that that was one of the most horrific, violent events our nation had seen. Unfortunately, the list of topics that rabbis now aren't supposed to talk about is longer than ever. And yes, I suspect that there are some rabbis who've gotten up in pulpits and haven't done a very good job. I will admit that not everyone in our profession speaks wisely from the pulpit, may abuse the right to stand up here, may get overly political, may not tease out all the religious and moral issues that are embedded in an issue. But even though a few rabbis may not have done a good job, that's not the reason why rabbis across the religious spectrum and from all regions of our nation are finding there are more and more topics that they can't talk about. If it was restricted to a few rabbis or one topic or one region, then we could say, well, it's very specific. But this is systemic. It speaks to something larger. And I would suggest it has nothing to do with the topics, nothing to do with the rabbis, and everything to do with the current state of Judaism. I think similar to the legend that we read last week and this week, we modern Jews, the Jewish community, is at a crossroads. More, we're in a crisis, and we aren't sure where we're going or who to listen to or which vision or version of Judaism we need to embrace in order to ensure that there's a future. The children of Israel, you could see, they were at a crossroads. Their lives of slavery had recently ended. They had been led out of Egypt by Moses. He had crossed the Red Sea, and he brought them to Mount Sinai. He told them, I'm going to go meet God. Wait for me here. Wait for me. I got some important business upstairs. And within a few weeks, just a few weeks of his absence, they became scared, frightened, even after everything they'd seen. Remember, they'd already seen miracle after miracle, and yet the rabbi said they couldn't wait. They turned from Moses, and they embraced Aaron and the golden calf. Rather than waiting for something new, they turned and embraced something they already knew to give them comfort and to relief. In the midst of uncertainty, they wanted certainty. In their journey to the future, they wanted to do something old and familiar. Rather than having the patience to wait and to allow the future to unfold, they wanted their answers now. And when Moses descended the mountain and returned to the children of Israel, there was conflict. Everyone was forced to pick sides. And not everyone survived the clash of visions that ensued. The scene at Mount Sinai wasn't one of happiness and joy and gregarity. It was one full of fear, chaos, and conflict. This was a myth, a story, a legend. But I think our ancestors captured a reality that transcends time and place. When there is uncertainty, when there's competing ideology, conflicts arise and conversations often cease, and communities become divided. When people aren't sure there's a future, they become frightened, and often the loudest voice is confused with being the most authentic. This is what's happening today within the Jewish community. The reason rabbis are being challenged about talks isn't their talks. It's about the Jewish community. We've reached a crossroads, and there is uncertainty about the future. And uncertainty breeds angst, and angst breeds energy and emotion, and oftentimes that energy and emotion spews out in unintended and uncontrollable ways. We sometimes do not even recognize why we're upset. It comes out from within us. Of course, our situation's dissimilar from the slaves. They were leaving hardship and journeying to a promised land. They had one leader, Moses. They had one vision, the vision he was giving them. But as soon as uncertainty arose, the wheels came off the bus, and they revolted. Our situation's different today. Today, we are seeing the end of the upward swing that we've been experiencing in Judaism since the end of World War II. Since the end of World War II, the Jewish community has been doing very well, particularly in America. Synagogues were in their heyday. More and more congregations were being created. Historic congregations were moving out into the suburbs, building incredible, magnificent buildings. Religious schools were bursting at the seams. There wasn't enough Shabbases to have enough to handle all the bar and bat mitzvahs. Rabbis were becoming leaders in politics. They were part of the secular community. Their voice was important. We were taking our place as Jews in the general society. Anti-Semitism seemed to be on the wane. And Israel was a beacon to many. The David of nations standing amongst these Goliaths. Israel brought unity to the Jewish community. But all that's changing. Synagogues are no longer in their heyday. They are struggling to survive. Congregations are going bankrupt. Not a euphemism, bankrupt. I know at least two congregations that have recently closed. Congregations are merging to figure out how to survive. Congregations are doing anything and everything they can to maintain memberships and to attract things. Our demographics are telling us that people are joining. Religious schools are shrinking, and the Jewish community is more unaffiliated than in past decades. And while Jewish leaders are still talking politics, our voices aren't as strong as they used to be. As our numbers in our community shrink, and as other groups are taking their place at the table, our political capital may not be what it used to be. Jewish communal organizations are struggling. Again, some are closing, merging, all trying to figure out how to gain financial strength. And Israel, once a simple and easy conversation, has become nuanced, complicated, and rather than simply uniting, it frequently divides. Anti-Semitism? Europe, we know, it seems to be on the rise. And study after study tells us the same thing. The Jewish future is unclear and clouded, and nobody knows how to stem the tide. So I would suggest that our collective psyche, the psyche of our community, is being affected by this reality. And our people are acting out. We are acting out. Angry with one another, upset when somebody says something that we disagree with because we're scared. Doesn't matter the topic. Angst rather than hope has become the underlying emotion. And given that we have no one leader and that no one person or organization is in charge, that we're a free and open community, which is good, we're not sure what unites us. We argue about the past. We argue about the present. We argue what rabbis can't or can't say. We argue because we're not sure what else to do. There doesn't seem to be a direction. And most of all, we argue about which is the most authentic voice of Judaism, even though most people aren't affiliated, even though the Jewish people can be understood as a culture. We argue about different approaches to religious life. We argue about which behavior or ritual defines who's Jewish. Added to all this angst is the stress of modern life. We live in complex times. People are looking for ways to re-energize, relax, gain a new perspective. And frankly, with all that's going on, people may want to come to synagogue and only hear things that they agree with, or simply make them feel good about what they already think. They don't want to hear rabbis address issues that are upsetting or deemed not to be religious. But we need to recognize that Judaism has always been about calling people to action. It's always been asking us to stretch ourselves to make the world better. Whether it's the prophets of the ancient world or modern rabbis denouncing racial injustice or demanding equality, Judaism has always asked us to be our better selves. Judaism has never been a religion that taught it'll be okay if you only believe. Judaism has always said you need to take action. And Judaism's uniqueness is made even more complicated today by the notion that all religions are just all the same, that there really isn't any difference between this religion or that religion. In his book, God is Not One, Stephen Prethero takes on this topic squarely. He addresses the notion that some say all religions are simply climbing up the same mountain, but they're climbing up from different faces. And when they get to the top, they're all going to discover the same reality. And Prethero makes clear, religions aren't all climbing the same mountain, different faces. In fact, religions are climbing up different mountains. At the core of different religions is the fact that they're addressing different issues that motivate or energize them. They're wrestling with different core issues. They're trying to solve different essential questions. He makes clear to treat all religions, if they are essentially the same, as both to diminish their uniqueness and specificity, but it also misses what motivates them. And I would add to that, that even when it's what we call the same religion, there are different philosophies, and they are different, and they have different meanings, different purposes, and different core issues. An ultra-Orthodox Jew is strikingly different intellectually, philosophically, than a conservative Jew. What we say here at Congregation Beth Adam is not said in other congregations. And all this is exacerbated when people say, it really doesn't matter. What we say at synagogue, who cares? Doesn't really matter. It's all the same. Besides, I don't believe any of it anyways. This approach bleeds the religious enterprise of any intellectual value it might have and reduces it to, which melody are we going to sing? A deep and strong religious enterprise is more than melodies. It's more than which tradition you do or don't do. It's more than whether you have more or less Hebrew. It's even more than whether you use the term God or not. It's about how you understand the term God and why you might use it or might not use it. It's about where do you see the source of ethics and morality? Is it human? Is it divine? Here we say it's human, and if it's human, how do we collectively and individually discern the principles upon which our ethics stand? It's about how we discover truth. Factual truth and emotional truth. Rejecting modern science isn't just rejecting scholarship. It's a rejection of the notion that we, human beings, have the capacity through reason, through insight, to discern how our universe functions, and then out of knowledge, learn how to act. It's about how do we cope with the reality that we are all finite, that we are all going to die. How do we cope with our mortality? It's about questions of authority and authenticity. It's about coping with uncertainty. Where does our strength come from? Our hope. It isn't about what color one's talis is or how one's large yarmulke is. When communities are fighting about melodies and tradition, the Jewish community has already lost. For me, it's not just about the future of Judaism. For me, it's how we understand our own religious philosophy and how it affects our lives. Our Judaism, our personal religious philosophy, isn't nice to have, an add-on, something we throw on every once in a while. Our religious philosophy is the practical system that helps us address these core issues about life for us personally and collectively. Our religious philosophy isn't just what we say here. If we can't carry what we say here out into the foyer, out into the world we function in every day, then it is of little value. We, like the children of Israel at the base of the mountains, we need to pick a side. Know which version of Judaism speaks to who we are, and we must, if we value an approach to Judaism, work to ensure that vision is supported. The future will be determined by those who are involved. It's like an election. If you don't vote, you don't get to complain. I know there is an aversion to picking sides. But sometimes, that's what is required of us. And be clear, one of the sides we can take at this time asserts that the Jewish community must have room for diversity, must accept that there is not one authentic version or vision of Judaism. We must pick a side that creates an open environment that supports and validates all forms of Judaism. Frankly, the Jewish community has been exceptional at making folks who embrace tradition feel welcomed. But I believe the community has fallen short in making those who embrace a non-authoritarian, non-ritualistic approach feel equally welcome. What we believe matters. What we say in synagogue matters. I know there are people who'd say, Bob, you talk about belief way too much. But belief matters. I think the historic strength of Judaism is that it offered a worldview to the people and a philosophy that allowed them to cope with the world. However, what is confusing people is they want to retain that same Judaism even though the world around it has changed. For Judaism to remain relevant, it must reflect modern realities and ideas and insights. That is what has allowed Judaism. It needs to evolve. Judaism doesn't exist separate from the world. It needs to be engaged in it. And our Judaism necessarily needs to be grounded in a scientific and naturalistic approach. We can't be the most scientific people most of the year and then walk into our synagogues and act as if the scientific revolution hasn't happened. We can't learn about literature and philosophy and then read the myths of our people and act as if we don't recognize what they are. We can't strive to understand the world we live in and then walk into synagogues and put blinders on. And we must embrace a religious philosophy that provides more than a framework upon which we stand. It must continue, as our ancestors have done, to ask us to be our better selves. Our Judaism must be driven by a commitment to the future, not just the Jewish future, but the future of all people. When we turned our eternal light into a solar light, and I spoke about that, that act was grounded in a worldview that says, help will not come from elsewhere. We human beings must take responsibility for our actions. We must not close our eyes to the writing on the wall. Help will not come from anywhere but ourselves. We must be cautious and we must be responsible. We must see our actions will not only count on how it affects our own lives, but how will it affect the lives of those who come after us? Too much of religion is focused on and being worried about the past. Are we living up to the rules of 100 years ago? Are we doing what the rabbis a generation ago said we should do? Can we find a verse in the text that allows us to do what we're doing? It's enough. It's enough. It's time to stop worrying about the past, how it saw itself and understood the world. It's time to start worrying about the future. We have generations to come that we have a responsibility to. We not only need to leave them a planet they can live on and sustain them, we have to make a society that will support them. We're still living in an age in which women are mistreated, are not treated equally. It's time for that to change. We have insights into human sexuality that our ancestors never had. We should be able to create a society in which gays, lesbian, transgendered individuals feel welcomed and supported. We should stop pretending that that science doesn't influence religion. It should. There are biomedical questions on the horizon that our ancestors would not even understand the question. And we need to be prepared to help the generations to come answer those questions. That's our responsibility. And our responsibility is to recognize that our world is getting smaller. Ebola. Right? 20 years ago, it existed, but now it's in our collective backyard. The world is getting smaller. Our resources are being used up. We have a small world in which we all are dependent. The reason Judaism is struggling with its future is because, as Marshall McLuhan said, we're rushing forward looking into the rearview mirrors of our cars. It's time to take our eyes off the rearview mirrors and start looking at the road ahead. We must spend less time worrying about our ancestors and spend more time thinking about our descendants. What we believe matters. It matters because it not only will serve as a ground upon which we stand, it will help us determine the decisions that we have to make. And believing that we have a responsibility to the future, that we have a responsibility to be informed, tells us we need to act from an informed position. And now is the time to be counted. If there is going to be a thriving, engaged, and relevant Jewish future, we need dynamic people involved now. We not only have to answer to ourselves, we're going to have to answer to our descendants.